Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, AWM Program Director Allison Sansoni talks with Charles Ardai, editor of the short story anthology Killer Come Back to Me, The Crime Stories of Ray Bradbury. This program took place August 17th, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. This is the final of three episodes in a row about Bradbury in the lead up to his August 22nd birthday. Happy birthday, Ray! Visit our special exhibit, Ray Bradbury, Inextinguishable, to learn more about the writing legend, on display now at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, everyone. My name's Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the museum. We're very grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Tonight is the latest in a number of programs we're offering in conjunction with the Bradbury exhibit. We're here to talk about one of the lesser known aspects of Bradbury's work, his crime fiction. Last year, Titan Books published a volume of Bradbury's crime stories called Killer Come Back to Me, out this year in paperback, and we're here tonight to talk about it with editor Charles Ardai. He's a writer and founder of Hard Case Crime, a line of pulp-style paperback crime novels. His writing has appeared in mystery magazines such as Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, gaming magazines, and a number of anthologies. He's also an award-winning novelist, and he has edited numerous short story collections.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I'm curious to, I'd like to start just a little bit by talking about your work at Hard Case Crime. What types of stories do you publish, and what are you looking at in terms of sources to find those stories?
It's interesting. We don't publish very many collections of short stories. This is only the second one we ever did. Mostly we publish novels. And Hard Case Crime came about because my old friend Max Phillips and I, he's a fellow novelist, we went out drinking one night and lamented the fact that no one was publishing the sort of old, slender, nicely designed paperback novels that used to sell for 25 cents in wire spinner racks and drugstores all over the country and all over the world. Nobody published books like that anymore. Books today were 350 pages long. They were big doorstops. You couldn't read them in a night. You couldn't cram them in a jeans pocket. They didn't have painted covers. They just had big type on the covers. We said, for some foolish reason, why don't we start a line of books like that? Again, why don't we do that? And you and I can each write one book for the volume, for the series. And that idea should have died with the night's drinking, but somehow we held on to it. And weeks later, Max came back. He's a graphic designer in addition to being a novelist. And he showed me what the covers could look like. And if anyone out there has seen Hard Case Crime books, we're known at least as much for our cover art as we are for the contents of our books. And when Max showed me what our covers could look like, which, for example, in the case of the Bradbury book is this beautiful painted covers with brand new paintings commissioned just for our books, I couldn't resist. So my job as the editor, he was the graphic designer. My job as the editor was to come up with books worthy of his covers. And so I set out to pull books from my collection. I have thousands of these books that I bought for 25 cents on a yard sale here or there. And to pull out of this collection of books that were published between the Depression and typically about 1970, the small fraction of them that are still really good reads today. Most books published then weren't even good reads then. They were at best modestly good reads, but there were a few, and all we needed was a few. So we set out to publish books by people like Earl Stanley Gardner, who created Perry Mason and who was a best-selling author once upon a time. But today his name is little known except by crossword puzzle aficionados because E-R-L-E fills in a square in four squares in crossword puzzles nicely. Lawrence Block, Donald Westlake, some less well-known people like Wade Miller, whose name is completely forgotten at this point, but wrote the book on which the Orson Welles movie Touch of Evil was based. And so we love the idea of unearthing undeservedly forgotten work from what is sometimes called the pulp era, the era of pulp fiction. And then we invited some current writers who love that period as much as we did to write brand new novels in the same style. Max and I each wrote one, and that was the beginning of Hard Case Crime. And so we set out basically to revive something that we dearly loved, not knowing whether anybody else in the world loved it as much as we did, and fully aware that we might publish a handful of books and never do any more, and that would be the end of it. That'd be okay. Here we are, fast forward, almost 20 years later, And we've published more than 100 books. Our authors have included people like Stephen King and Michael Crichton, who decided they wanted to get in on the action when they saw our covers. We worked with Mickey Spillane toward the end of his life, Ed McBain toward the end of his life. Sadly, we came at the end of the lives of a lot of this generation of author. But the flip side of that, sadly, is happily, we did get to meet and work with them. And what a treasure that was. I never did get to work directly with Ray Bradbury, but he was an author I revered from childhood. I think every child in America, maybe every child in the world, reads some of his core short stories. Stories like The Veldt, I think, are required reading everywhere. And unlike most required reading, are a pleasure to read. And it wasn't obvious to me that we would ever get the opportunity to publish Bradbury. But I was talking with the son of his longtime literary agent, Michael Congdon. Ray worked with Don Congdon, Michael's father. And we came up with the idea of publishing a collection for his 100th birthday, Ray's 100th birthday, that would focus on his crime short stories, because that had never really been done or done to Ray's satisfaction. There was one paperback collection that was done in the 1980s that he didn't like, and he refused to allow to be reprinted. It only had one printing ever, and he agreed to let it happen once on the condition that it never be published again. The reason for that was maybe 6 or 7 of the stories in the book were quite good, but the other 10 were journeyman work from his early days, and he wasn't proud of them, and that's fine. So we said, let's take the 6 or 7 from that book that were genuinely outstanding or had something really interesting about them, and let's add to it other crime stories that we will pick out because we genuinely love them. And we'll make this the crime collection that the first one ought to have been, but wasn't. He said, that's a fun idea. And that's where Killer Come Back to Me came from. It has some obscure stories, some rarities, those are always fun for people to discover, as well as some classics, some stories people will recognize from adaptations that ran on the old Ray Bradbury theater TV series. And some other TV shows like Thriller, I think, and maybe Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And what you come away with when you read these stories is a sense of just how exquisite Ray Bradbury's prose was, regardless of what genre he was writing in, but also how he was able to adapt to the needs of a very different genre. He's known for his work in the fields of the fantastic and the weird, which have very different plotting requirements than a mystery or a crime story. And the man was a natural at it. I think in his early days, he wrote a little of everything. And he had passionate fondness for certain crime writers like Lee Brackett, who was a friend of his. And he would write a story a day. And at that pace, well, some would be terrible, I'm sure, but enough were good that you can compile a wonderful, wonderful book out of it. And so it's a book we're very proud of. Sorry to ramble on so long about this, but that gives you the general source of the book.
Yeah. Well, Ray, I was going to ask you, you touched on, you know, a number of things that I wanted us to expand on a little bit. You know, Ray Bradbury tends to get dismissed or shoehorned into this hard sci-fi or the fantasy realms. And a lot of people don't know how versatile he was. What did he bring as a writer to the crime fiction genre?
I think the crime fiction that people remember best from this period being roughly the end of World War II to 2 decades later, the best-selling author of that time was Mickey Spillane, and there was no poetry in Mickey Spillane. There were guns, there were women, there were fights, there was no poetry. And today, he's not as widely read or revered as he was in the early days. But the author people do remember and love is Raymond Chandler. And what Raymond Chandler did was tell roughly the same sort of stories that Mickey Spillane told, but with the ear of a poet. And that's what Ray Bradbury brought to the genre as well. In fact, to every genre he ever touched. His concepts, his premises were sometimes quite clever. Sometimes they were ingenious. But I don't think that's the main thing people remember Ray for. When you read one of his stories, when you dip into it, you realize that it's a very different use of language than other authors in this genre use. Some of the finest authors, the people that we remember with great fondness, Arthur Conan Doyle, who created Sherlock Holmes, his prose is tasty. It's not poetry, it's functional. It has a certain period charm today because it's Victorian, and so you enjoy that, but it's not poetry. Ray Bradbury's prose really is lyrical in a way, and his word choices are careful in a way that you don't see in many practitioners of the mystery writing art. So I think that is what set him apart from his peers. He also had some subject matter choices that were simply riveting. He loved carnivals. He loved ventriloquists. He loved things that were dark and peculiar. And, you know, the dark and peculiar aspect of it is also one of the reasons we keep coming back to Ray Bradbury. He makes us shiver a little bit. And that's a wonderful thing.
You mentioned the difference in requirements in terms of writing this type of story. Can you elaborate a little bit on what that difference is and how Bradbury addressed it?
I think in a crime story, you're expected to surprise people. You're expected to startle people with the outcome of the story. If you establish a mystery and it ends the way the reader expects, there's a certain amount of disappointment there. And so you have to have a kind of reversal. And it's built into the genre, and you're obliged to do it. Now, there are certain stories of Ray's that are crime stories, but not mysteries. And when you are telling a crime story that's not a mystery, you don't necessarily have to have that twist, and you don't have to have that surprise solution. But in his fantasy and science fiction in particular, you don't need that at all. Now, he often had it. He had stories that did surprise you at the end. But he had other stories where the principal effect was introducing you to a world you'd never seen before. So a science fiction or fantasy story can be what I think of as a world-building story. This is what life is like on Venus. This is what life is like on Mars. This is what life would be like if you could travel through time. And yes, perhaps if you step on a butterfly, spoiler alert, the future you return to won't be as good as the one you left. And that's a surprise ending. But a lot of the pleasures of science fiction don't depend on that sort of twist in the tale. For crime stories, you require that a little bit more. Although, having said that, the twist doesn't have to be a plot twist. And that's one of the things you find in Bradbury's work as he developed, as he matured. Some of his early stories for crime pulp magazines like Dime Detective really were sort of rigidly within the genre and had the twist at the end and delivered it in a kind of, not a mechanical way, because that's unfair to his writing style, but in a predictable way, in the sense that a limerick predictably comes back to the initial rhyme scheme in its final line. A sonnet has 14 lines. Is that predictable? It is predictable. It doesn't make it any less artful. But in his later works, the surprise at the end of the story was often driven by character rather than by plot. And so the story, for instance, the two stories that we end this collection on are relatively later stories. They come from a few decades after the book begins. And in those two stories, while there is a twist at the end, there is a surprising ending, what's surprising about it is how a character deals with a crisis of the heart, a crisis of faith, a crisis of identity. Who am I? What have I chosen to do with my life? And makes a choice that is at odds with the one you thought he was going to make earlier in the story. That's a twist as well, but that's the kind of twist that a more sophisticated author will bring to the page. And so Ray Bradbury went from a journeyman author who was trying to make a penny a word like anybody else during the Depression, to an author of great repute who had, among other things, the talent and the freedom, because of his reputation, to write as he wished and to tell the stories he wished. The wonderful thing is he never abandoned his genres. He kept writing crime stories. He kept writing science fiction, fantasy, because clearly he loved it. At some point, he could have said, I'll put that behind me, the way Kurt Vonnegut, for instance, did. And he kind of repudiated science fiction. By the way, Vonnegut is one of my favorite authors, along with Bradbury. But there was a point at which he said, I'm not a science fiction writer. I'm a literary writer. Bradbury was every bit as much a literary writer, but he never abandoned the genre. And that's one of the things I love him for.
It's always interesting to see that point in a writer's development when they have sort of left the realm of needing to do a certain thing and decide they can do whatever they like. Right. What do they stick with, or where do they go?
It really is. It's a little bit like what happens when a stand-up comedian starts out extremely funny, telling jokes about the ordinary conventional life that he or she has, but then becomes enormously successful. And I think I heard Jerry Seinfeld talking about this. How do you still tell stand-up comedy jokes when your life has gone from a normal, relatable life to being a wealthy, successful TV producer and TV star? How do you keep telling that story? Well, writers have a similar problem. They're not performing on a stage, but they perform at a typewriter. And if their lives have changed so dramatically, how do they stay in touch with where they came from? And not every writer does. Not every writer remains good, but Ray Bradbury's work remained exceptional up to the end. He wasn't writing with as much prolificity at the end as he was at the beginning. It was no longer a story a day. But his late work is beautiful and refined and wonderful without losing what made Bradbury Bradbury.
There's such a range in the stories in Killer Come Back to me, the different settings, the different time periods. Is there a through line to them that that you feel people will see when they read it?
I think the answer is yes, but I have to tell you, some of it has to do with my own obscure OCD tendencies. So for instance, there were three stories in the book that had trains in them. But I didn't think the right thing to do would be to have three train stories back to back. On the other hand, I loved all three, so I didn't want to cut any of them out. So what I did was make the first story in the book a train story, the last story in the book a train story, and at the geographic center of the book, the third train story. So if somebody wants to read the book from one end to the other instead of dipping in here and there, they'll find that they're taking a journey on a train from the first story to the middle to the end. That's an example of a through line, although I don't know if anyone else will care about it. There are some patterns that you see. After the first story, you see two stories in which children are ignored or disbelieved by the adults around them. And then in the third story, you have an adult of limited mental capacity who is disbelieved and not trusted by the adults around him. And you see that theme emerge from the first to the second to the third of the three stories. There's a portion of the book that has two stories back to back that were originally published several years apart. The first story was famously included in the novel Dandelion Wine. It became a chapter, actually, I think a chapter and a half of Dandelion Wine with some modifications. But it began as a short story, and it posited some spinsters in a small town, in small town America in the middle of the century, who were walking home from a movie show at late at night in a town where a serial strangler was at large. And they were variously terrified and brave. And at the end of the story, without giving too much away, one of the women who has walked alone through a ravine has made it home only to discover something unexpected. But it ends, the story ends on a very unresolved note. It's a little like The Lady or the Tiger, the famous story where you have two doors and behind one there's a lady and behind the other is a tiger. And you don't know which one comes out. And no less a personage in the mystery field than Frederick Danet, whose name is not widely known, but his creation probably is still heard of, which is Ellery Queen. Fred Danet and Manfred B. Lee, cousins from Brooklyn, created the detective Ellery Queen and wrote quite a few novels about Ellery Queen under the pen name Ellery Queen, on the theory that if you ask readers to remember only one name, they're more likely to than if you ask them to remember two. So they didn't have a separate pseudonym and detective. It was all one name. And Fred Danet edited a magazine called Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, which is where I published my first fiction back in the 1980s. Well, he went to Ray Bradbury and he said, "You've written this open-ended story, and I think you should write a sequel to it." And Ray apparently said, "Oh, I don't have any ideas for a sequel. Thank you, but no." And then he went back to his typewriter and wrote a sequel. And that sequel, I believe the title is At Midnight in the Month of June. I always check because these lyrical titles, often I get the words wrong, the order of the words wrong. At Midnight in the Month of June picks up exactly to the second where the first story ended. And so, of course, even though they were written years apart and might have been separated chronologically in the table of contents, I put those back to back. So when you ask about a through line, that's an example of a case where I put two stories back to back because they needed to be together. They fit together. In another case, there were two stories in what Ray called his marionette series, where there was a company called Marionettes, Inc. that would produce perfectly human-looking robots. They were run by clockwork inside, but on the outside, they looked perfectly like human beings, and they thought and spoke like human beings? And what kind of trouble can you get up to as a mystery writer if you do that? For instance, let's say you're a man who wants to commit murder. You have a reason, a passionate reason to kill somebody, but you don't want to get arrested for it. Well, you can hire Marionettes Inc. and they can make a robot that looks just like the person you want to kill. And you'll kill this robot. But is that murder? Because after all, this robot is indistinguishable from a human being. What a wonderful premise for a story. Well, we have two marionette stories in the book. I put those together. So you'll see various pairings that make logical sense when you go through the book, but that's no reason that somebody couldn't read it backwards or read it out of order. I think it's fine either way.
And you touched on this a little bit, but are there other examples of things that within this collection that Bradbury wrote very early in his career that then are harbingers of his later work?
There definitely are stories that he wrote early in his career. And then the question of how harbingery they are, to coin a word, is you want to not dig too deep for patterns for fear of inventing them instead of unearthing them. But I think the answer is yes. So, for instance, there's one rare story in the book. Again, I'll check the title. The title is Where Everything Ends, and it is a story set in California, in the canals. There are sunken circus wagons at the bottom of one of these water-filled canals. And this was very clearly a dry run for a mystery novel he wrote later, the very first mystery novel he wrote, that was sort of a dedicated mystery-only, non-fantastic novel. I believe the title was Death is a Lonely Business. And it picks up the premise, and a lot of what Bradbury worked out in the novel began in this early version. So that's perhaps the clearest example of a piece of writing that later became a more mature work. And then, of course, there's the whole Town Sleeping, which is the prequel to At Midnight in the Month of June, which became part of Dandelion Wine. So clearly was part of his writing about that. But are there others? I think at a very high level, the answer is yes, because, for instance, so much of Bradbury's writing has to do with children. And you see children appearing in these stories. And the children have a kind of privileged access to a world of imagination, which in Bradbury is often a world of heightened truth, that adults don't have. That unless adults find a way to recapture some quality from their own childhood, they are stunted. It's a little like Blake, who wrote about his perceptions being closed off as an adult. And, you know, this notion of the innocent child versus the experienced adult. I think Bradbury had a soft spot in his heart for children, which isn't to say he never saw them as malicious or capable of great cruelty. But this notion that childhood is a special time and the source of magic, and that magic is worth finding a way back to in adulthood, you'll see that in his later work, and you'll see it in his more accomplished work if you read the novels. So one interesting thing about Bradbury, and I didn't really appreciate this until I sat down to curate this book, is that he's really a short story writer. He wrote very few novels. It's a little bit like Harlan Ellison, who wrote a few novels, but primarily wrote short stories and essays. Bradbury wrote half a dozen novels, that's it. And of course, they're among the most famous ever written, Fahrenheit 451, Something Wicked This Way Comes, Dandelion Wine, but that's it. And then he wrote three or four mystery novels. And I'm probably forgetting something. The October Country, I suppose, although you could see that as a compilation in after a fashion. Martian Chronicles really is a compilation. Illustrated Man's a compilation. Wonderful, every one of them, but his primary mode was short stories. So when you ask, did he eventually graduate? You didn't ask this, but if you ask, did he eventually graduate from short stories to something more accomplished? I think he was at his most accomplished, ultimately, as a short story writer.
Is there evidence that he was influenced by particular crime writers, or that he himself then influenced that genre?
Well, he was definitely influenced by other crime writers. So if you look at the very back of Killer Come Back to Me, there is a short essay he wrote about his development as a crime writer and how he idolized Lee Brackett, who today is perhaps most famous as for having written the first draft of the script for The Empire Strikes Back shortly before her death. And I think George Lucas used none of what she wrote. So it's a shame. She was a terrific writer, mostly known for science fiction. But Bradbury writes about how he admired her crime writing so much, and he would type up his short stories and carry them to Lee Brackett, and they would sit on the beach and she would read his short stories and give critique. And so there definitely were people like that, and I think other writers in her circle that he admired and to some extent as a young writer was trying to imitate or to learn from. On the other end, it's funny, I don't think too many crime writers would acknowledge being influenced by Bradbury, but I'll give you one who clearly is and would say so, and that's Stephen King. Now, people think of Stephen King as a horror writer, and he is that, but he's so much more as well. And in recent years especially, he's written several books, and in fact, an entire series of books that were crime stories with essentially no or literally no paranormal element to them. He wrote Mr. Mercedes, for which he won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Mystery Novel of the Year. He wrote three books for Hard Case Crime, for which I will be eternally grateful. That is an act of enormous generosity on his part, since he could publish his books with anyone. It doesn't have to be with my little labor of love operation. He wrote a book for us called The Colorado Kid, then one 8 years later called Joyland, set in a carnival, which clearly was influenced by Bradbury, small town carnival with a very nostalgic flavor. And then he wrote one just this year called Later, which is about a young boy who has the ability to see and speak to the recently dead. And so every one of King's books, I think, has a little bit of Bradbury in it. But in particular, the three books he wrote for us have a lot of Bradbury in them. And in fact, I told Stephen King that we were doing this book because I knew how much he loved Bradbury. And his immediate reaction, as soon as he heard about this book, it was already at the typesetter. And he said, well, did you use Heavyset? You know, he didn't have to think twice. He had a story on the tip of his tongue, and not a famous story either. And I hadn't even heard of Heavyset. And I went and I read it. What a terrific story it was. And I said, Steve, it's for the second volume because it's too late. This was already at the printers. Or typesetters, one way or the other. So I wasn't able to get that story in, but I have the seed on which to grow a second volume, should we ever choose to. Heavyset is an interesting story because it's not obviously a crime story. But if you get to the end of it and you think about it, the crime that takes place is perhaps the most horrific of any Bradbury ever wrote. I will leave it there. But I can see why Stephen King admires it so much. So I think in writing not only his horror novels, but his crime fiction, Stephen King was influenced by Bradbury. I think other people like David Scow, who wrote a book for us called Gunwork, but is better known as a screenwriter. He wrote the screenplay for a movie called The Crow. Joe Lansdale, who has some fantastical qualities to his fiction. Certainly Michael Crichton, the late Michael Crichton, who we worked with, and we published eight of his early pseudonymous potboilers that he wrote under the name John Lang, and he invited us to reprint them, but only if we didn't tell anyone it was him until after he was dead. Crichton, I think, was influenced by Bradbury as well. But the sort of core realist crime writers, the ones who scoff at anything fantastical, they would never admit that they read Bradbury. But they did. I know they did, because there isn't a reader alive, much less a writer, who hasn't read Bradbury. So I think his influence is there in the air. It's like the air we breathe.
It's interesting because he, in almost all of his work, regardless of what genre he was working in, he's telling you a story, but it's not the story you think you're going to hear.
Absolutely.
And that seems to be where his work lands. Is that true in his crime fiction as well?
It is, although, of course, in a short story as compared to a novel, you have to get to what the story genuinely is about a bit sooner than you otherwise would. But there are definitely stories where you don't realize until perhaps the last page what the story really was about. So, for instance, one of my favorite stories in this book, Dead Men Rise Up Never, which is the source of the floating the brown cathedral and the floating woman. That story appears to be a kidnapping story. Some organized crime figures are fighting over some young woman who dies in the course of a kidnapping. But it's not really about that at all. It's about the crime boss who genuinely loved this woman and is heartbroken at her death. Even though he's a killer, but she wasn't supposed to die. And his grief is what the story is really about. Now, who could possibly have sold a story to a pulp magazine by saying, hey, editor, I'm picturing a guy with a green eye shade, I'm going to write you a story about grief. I guarantee the editor would have said, don't give me grief, give me gunfights. And so in these stories, you often begin with gunfights, or you begin with something that is more conventionally suited to the genre. But by the time you get to the end, Bradbury's demons creep out onto the surface and you realize what really motivated him to write this story. There's one called The Fruit at the Bottom of the Bowl. Fruit at the Bottom of the Bowl was, I forget where it was originally published. It was eventually published, reprinted in Ellery Queen. And there's a man who has committed murder. And the murder has happened before the story begins. He just wants to cover his tracks. And he starts wiping down every surface he might have touched. And then he thinks of another surface he might have touched. He wipes that. And then he thinks, well, what about the walls? What about the furniture? What about the cutlery? And at the end of the night, when the police finally show up, he's obsessively wiped every surface in the home, and he hasn't been able to leave. He hasn't been able to escape. In the course of preparing for his escape, he's gotten himself caught. Well, what's that story really about? It's not really about wiping cutlery. It's about guilt, and it's about the repercussions of your behavior and how you become trapped. And it's hard to see that level of depth in many authors of crime short stories. Not all. There are some outstanding writers out there. But it's nice that with Bradbury, you get the pleasure of the delicious prose, and you get the clever premise, and you get the amusing twist at the end. But there's almost always another layer below it that gives you something deeper.
I just want to remind folks as we're talking here that they can type a question into the Q&A box if you have one, and then in a couple of minutes we'll start asking those questions. So please type them into the Q&A.
I'm grateful to everyone who asks questions. I'm also grateful to you in particular, because I am so gruesomely myopic that if I wanted to read the questions myself, I would have to lean in and you'd see this enormous close up of an eye.
So, oh no, we'll read them out. We'll read them out for you.
You're kind. I appreciate it.
While folks are getting their questions in, I wanted to ask if you had a passage that you'd like to read for us.
Sure, I would be delighted. I was just flipping through the book. I thought, why don't we start at the end? The last story in the book may well be my favorite, and I like leaving on a really strong note. You want the first story in a book and the last story in a book to be exceptional. In this case, of course, you had an embarrassment of riches to choose from. This story is called The Utterly Perfect Murder, and I won't get far into it, but I'll read a page or two just to give you a sense of how Ray Bradbury writes crime fiction. The Utterly Perfect Murder. It was such an utterly perfect, such an incredibly delightful idea for murder that I was half out of my mind all across America. The idea had come to me for some reason on my 48th birthday. Why it hadn't come to me when I was 30 or 40, I cannot say. Perhaps those were good years. And I sailed through them unaware of time and clocks and the gathering of frost at my temples or the look of the lion about my eyes. Anyway, on my 48th birthday, lying in bed that night beside my wife, with my children sleeping through all the other quiet, moonlit rooms of my house, I thought, I will arise and go now and kill Ralph Underhill. Ralph Underhill, I cried. Who in God's name is he? 36 years later? Kill him? For what? Why, I thought, for what he did to me when I was 12. My wife woke an hour later, hearing a noise. Doug, she called. What are you doing? Packing, I said, for a journey. Oh, she murmured and rolled over and went to sleep. Board, all aboard. The porter's cries went down the train platform. The train shuddered and banged. See you, I cried, leaping up the steps. Someday, called my wife, I wish you'd fly. Fly, I thought, and spoil thinking about murder all across the plains. Spoil oiling the pistol and loading it and thinking of Ralph Underhill's face when I show up 36 years late to settle old scores. Fly? Why, I would rather pack cross country on foot, pausing by night to build fires and fry my bile and sour spit and eat again my old mummified but still living antagonisms and touch those bruises which have never healed. Fly? The train moved. My wife was gone. I rode off into the past. Now, who writes like that? You tell me.
I can see where you come around to poetry.
There you go.
The rhythm, the sound, the way that he uses words to sort of build that cadence.
It's just lovely. It's a pleasure to read out loud.
Yeah. So we're going to ask a few of the audience questions here. Really? So folks, we've got time for a few more if you want to type those into the chat for us. And so we have a question here from Michelle Kurlander, who wants to know about a crossover between this book and the book that she has, which is called The Cat's Pajamas. Ah. Any comments on that book of stories?
You know, I've seen The Cat's Pajamas on various Kindle screens. When I was doing some research for this book, I picked up Kindle editions of some of the Bradbury collections just to have quick access to digital copies of some of the stories. Because otherwise, for instance, I had my old issues of Ellery Queen from the 1950s, but they're very fragile and photocopying them would have been hard. And so I saw Cat's Pajamas, but I don't actually know how much overlap there is. There may, for all I know, be overlap. There may be one or two stories that are in both books. I'd be curious to know that, but I'd have to go to my shelf and check. I think Cat's Pajamas was one of the later collections, I believe. It may even have been posthumous. I don't remember. And I think almost always the Bradbury collections that I've seen have a kind of smorgasbord approach. I'm not aware of another one that is sort of narrowly focused by genre, except to the extent that some of them are all fantasy. But what you generally find is some combination of stories set on Earth, stories set in outer space, stories that are humorous, stories that are very dark. So our goal with this book was to have a kind of coherent meal that would follow from course to course and give you a sense at the end that you, forgive the metaphor, that you ate something where all the dishes went together, which isn't to say that a smorgasbord is bad. I like myself a good buffet, but this was something very different, sort of an act of curation that was meant to deliver a unified experience rather than a varied one.
Question from Kimberly Harrison, who says, what a treat to have another Bradbury collection. Thank you. Which of these stories are you most gratified to know will be rediscovered and not lost to history?
The final two stories, I think, are among the most likely to have disappeared otherwise, because they don't come from the core years of Bradbury's popularity, and they're not the sort for which he's best known. And these two stories are called Some Live Like Lazarus and The Utterly Perfect Murder. You just heard the beginning of The Utterly Perfect Murder. Both stories brought me to tears. I'm not ashamed to say it. You get to the end of these stories and you feel your heart moving up into your throat. Any author who can do that deserves to be remembered. Of course, there's no real danger Bradbury as a writer will be forgotten. But why should he write two such moving, touching stories and not have those stories read? So I'm particularly proud of those, but I love them all.
That's like asking which of your children is your favorite, right?
I mean, I'll be fair. I think that's actually dishonest. No one loves everything. And there are a few stories in the book that I don't love as stories, but I included because they were important to Bradbury's development or historically important or very rare, and people didn't have any other opportunity to read them. I would say out of about 20 stories in the book, 18 are stories I truly love. And probably two are curiosities. They're well worth reading, even those. But to give you the honest appraisal, I would say 18 truly outstanding stories and two that are worth reading, but not at the same level of quality.
The question here from Cindy, what's the youngest age that should read Bradbury's book, Killer Come Back to Me?
There's nothing in the book that is so graphic, either in terms of violence or sex or language, as you can imagine. I mean, how could that possibly not be the case that any child would be put off by it or any parent to give it? I've read aloud some of the stories from the book to my daughter, who's now 10 and a half, but was probably 9 and a half when I read it. 9 and a half is fine. I was reading Bradbury when I was 9 and a half. I don't know that I'd go younger than 9, 8. I mean, a precocious 8-year-old might be fine. But the thing is, these are crime stories, so people are getting murdered in them. And you might need to walk people through some of the peculiarities that don't exist anymore or aren't as commonly found in fiction. So there's a scene in a carnival with Siamese twins, and you might have to explain, what are Siamese twins? why do we now refer to them as conjoined twins rather than Siamese twins? Is it really plausible that if one Siamese twin was murdered, the other could play detective and solve his brother's murder? Well, highly unlikely. But what a wonderful story it is. So I think there may be some good meat for conversation, but I would have no problem sharing it with a 9, 10, 11-year-old. That would be just fine.
It's more of a tolerance for the fear aspect.
I think that's right. These are really mostly not horror stories. There's one story in the book that has a quality of horror to it and a kind of gruesome ending, but the vast majority of them are not that. But they tend to be sad stories. They're a little bit mournful, and it may require a certain amount of maturity to really appreciate that.
I have a question from Ariana Miller, who wants to know if there are plans for an audiobook version.
Well, that's interesting. You know, we didn't purchase the audiobook rights to this book. We don't ever buy the audiobook rights, and we just invite the authors to sell it on their own and get extra money that way. And generally, our best-known authors do separately sell the audiobook rights, but we don't necessarily know it when they do, unless the audiobook publisher comes to us and says, I love your cover art so much, can we use your cover art? Then, of course, we hear about it. So I don't know if there's an audiobook version of this one coming. I would love that. What a wonderful idea that is. I even read it, but I mean, perform it if anyone would want that. But I don't know. So that's an interesting question. I'm going to go check. Obviously, the easiest way to find out if there's one in the works now is to go to Amazon and look it up. I know there are probably some folks on the call tonight who have critical or negative things to say or feel about Amazon, and I understand that. But it is a resource, and you don't have to buy it there, but you can certainly check there to see if it exists.
And, you know, while we're on the topic of Bradbury adaptations, we have a program coming up with the Newbery Library next month, talking about Bradbury and Melville.
And, oh, interesting. Oh, Moby Dick, his work in The Lighthouse.
Yeah.
That'll be great. I hope I get to watch it.
Yeah. That'll be fantastic. So if that's something people are interested in, be sure to check that out. We have a question here from Pamela, who wants to know, did Bradbury ever write a book or a short story from a woman's point of view?
Yes. I can't tell you for sure if he ever wrote a book from a woman's point of view. But in this book, there is at least one short story that is from a young girl's point of view. It's The Screaming Woman. When that was adapted to the Ray Bradbury Theater, Drew Barrymore was still a child, fresh off her success in the movie E.T., and she was cast in the main role. And the story begins, my name is Margaret Leary, and I'm 10 years old, and in the fifth grade at Central School. I haven't any brothers or sisters, but I've got a nice father and mother, except they don't pay much attention to me. I don't think that's the only one either. I think there are a number of stories in this collection with female protagonists.
A question from, it's not really a question, more of a comment from Bran Statler, who mentions the washing of the house by the murderer, referring to the fruit at the bottom of the bowl, reminds him of an allusion to Shakespeare, to Macbeth.
Lady Macbeth, not all the water in the seas can remove the blood from my hands. That's right. I think clearly you'll find Shakespeare allusions, Greek mythology allusions throughout Bradbury, and God knows he was a well-read author. This is a rather extreme form of Lady Macbeth's compulsion, but I think you're right. I never thought of that connection, but I think that's true.
A question here from Michelle. Bradbury, to me, is one of the great American writers, but it's incredibly upsetting that he doesn't get the kind of respect that someone like Vonnegut does. Do you think it's only because he was a genre writer or because he wasn't interested in kissing up to the literary elites of the time?
I think it is. I think it's mostly because he didn't abandon the genre, the very thing I love him for. Vonnegut was playing in the sandbox with literary writers. On the other hand, to be fair to the literary establishment, I think they have adopted Fahrenheit 451. I don't think anyone would argue that Fahrenheit 451 is not part of the literary canon. And so for that alone, Bradbury has been elevated. But, you know, I regret that people want to be elevated, that they run from the genre label. What is genre writing but entertainment and pleasure? And why do we read other than for entertainment and pleasure? Well, there are answers. We read for illumination, as I think Indiana Jones's dad put it in the third movie. But Bradbury gives us both. And too many literary writers only give you the attempted illumination without the entertainment. So I celebrate genre writers, especially when they do give you both, because if you don't find yourself engaged by a book, you won't finish it. And so the genre writer does you the great favor of giving you the spoonful of sugar with the medicine to go down.
I think that is all of our audience questions for this evening. I want to thank you so much for being here with us tonight and for talking about Bradbury. This is a fantastic conversation, and I think we're all a lot smarter for it.
Oh, I don't know about that, but you're very kind to have me. It was genuinely a pleasure. Talking about Bradbury is a great joy, and I hope people enjoy the book if they do pick it up. It's a book that means a lot to me, and it gave me great pleasure to edit it. And I think anyone who does like Bradbury's work will enjoy it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we hear from journalist and editor Ellie Fishman about her book Refugee High, Coming of Age in America, winner of the Studs and Ida Terkel Award. The book tells the story of a year in the life of a Chicago high school that has one of the highest proportions of refugees of any school in the nation. Ellie is interviewed by Alex Kotlowitz, award-winning author of American Summer and the national bestseller There Are No Children Here. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.